Moreover, we know less savoury intelligence as well. Which officers prefer the unwilling company of red soldiers? The Lord General Osanos, the nymph governor of the West Lakes region and commander of the city, continues a family feud with Lord General Laris, commander of the entire Norton Air Fleet. Who is essential to the military and who wears rank for show? The list goes on. Petty rivalries and weaknesses to be exploited. There are places of rot for us to poke at. If command doesn't see this, then they must be blind. But I am not. And today is the day I set foot inside the walls myself and see the worst of what Norta has to offer tomorrow's revolution. Kara folds up her broadcaster and reattaches it to the cord around her neck. It stays with her always, nestled next to her heart. Not even to the colonel, she asks, to gloat. Not today, I force my best smirk. It placates her. And it convinces me. The last 2 weeks have been a gold mine of information. The next two will certainly be the same. I force my way out of the stuffy shuttered closet we use for transmissions, the only part of the abandoned house with four walls and an intact roof. The rest of the structure does its job well, serving as the safe house for our dealings in Corvium. The main room, as long as it is wide, has brick walls, though one side is collapsed along with the rusted tin roof. And the smaller chamber, probably a bedroom, has no roof at all. Not that we mind. The Scarlet Guard has suffered worse. And the nights have been unseasonably warm, albeit humid. Summer is coming to Norta. Our plastic tents keep out the rain, but not the moist air. It's nothing, I tell myself. A mild discomfort. But sweat drips down my neck anyway. And it's not even midday yet. Trying to ignore the sticky sensation that comes with the rising humidity, I pile my braid on top of my head, wrapping it like a crown. If this weather keeps up, I might just cut it all off. He's late, Tristan says from his lookout at a glassless window. His eyes never still, always darting, searching. I'd be worried if he wasn't. Barrow hasn't been on time once in the past 2 weeks, not for any of our meetings. Kara joins Ty in the corner, dropping down with a merry flop. She sets to cleaning her glasses as intently as Ty cleans pistols. Both of them share the same look. Fair-haired Lakelanders. Like me, they're not used to the May heat, and they cluster together in the shade. Tristan is not so affected. He's a Piedmont boy originally, a son of mild winter and swampy summer. The heat doesn't bother him. In fact, the only indicator of the changing season are his freckles, which seem to breed. They dot his arms and face more every day, and his hair is longer too, a dark red mop that curls in the humidity. I told him as much, Rasha says from the opposite corner. She busies herself braiding her hair out of her dark face, taking care to divide her curling black locks into even pieces. Her own rifle, not so long as Tristan's, but just as well used, props against the wall next to her. Starting to think they don't sleep down in Piedmont. If you want to know more about my sleeping habits, all you have to do is ask, Rasha, Tristan replies. This time he turns over his shoulder, just for a second, to meet her black eyes. They share a knowing look. I fight the urge to scoff. Keep it to the woods, you two, I mutter. Hard enough sleeping on the ground without listening to rustling tents. Scout still out? Tari and Shore are taking the ridge. They won't be back until dusk. Same as B. Coop and Martinson. Tristan ticks off the rest of our team on his fingers. Christobel and little Coop are about a mile out in the trees, waiting on your barrow boy and looking to wait a while. I nod. All in order, then. Command happy so far? Happy as they can be, I lie as smoothly as I can. Thankfully, Tristan doesn't turn from his watch. He doesn't notice the flush I feel creeping up my neck. We're feeding good intelligence. Worth our time, for sure.
They looking to Aussie's tree or barrow?
What makes you say that?
He shrugs. Seems like a long time to put into a pair we don't mean to recruit. Or are you suggesting them for stage two?
Tristan doesn't mean to pry. He's a good lieutenant, the best I've ever seen, loyal to his bones. He doesn't know what he's picking at, but it stings all the same. Still working that out, I mumble, doing my best to walk slow as I run from his questions. I'm going to do a turn around the property. Grab me if Barrow shows his face.
Will do, boss, echoes from the room.
Keeping my steps even is a battle, and it seems like an eternity before I'm safely into the green trees. I heave a single collecting breath, forcing myself to calm down. It's for the best. Lying to them, disobeying the orders, it's for the best. It's not your fault the Colonel doesn't understand. It's not your fault. The old refrain levels me out, as comforting as a stiff drink. Everything I've done and everything I will do is for the cause. No one can say otherwise. No one will ever question my loyalty, not once I give them Norta on a silver platter. A smile slowly replaces my usual scowl. My team doesn't know what's coming. Not even Tristan. They don't know what Command has planned for this kingdom in the coming weeks, or what we've done to put things in motion. Grinning, I remember the whirring video camera. The words I said in front of it. Soon, the world will hear them. I don't like the woods here. They're too still, too quiet, with the smell of ash still clinging to the air. Despite the living trees, this is a dead place. Nice time for a walk. My pistol jams against his temple before I have time to think. Somehow, Barrow doesn't flinch. He only raises his palms in mock surrender. You're a special kind of stupid, I say. He chuckles.
Must be, since I keep wandering back to your ragtag rebel club.
And you're late.
I prefer chronologically challenged.
With a humorless scoff, I holster the gun, but keep my hand on it. I narrow my eyes at him. Usually his uniform is turned inside out for camouflage, but this time he hasn't bothered. His jacket is red as blood, dark and worn. He sticks out against the greenery.
I've got two spotters waiting on you. They must not be very good.
Again that smile. Another would think Shade Barrow was warm, open, always laughing. But there's a chill beneath all that, an iron cold.
I came the usual way.
Sneering, I pat his jacket. Did you now? There. His eyes flash, chips of frozen amber. Shade Barrow has secrets of his own, just like everyone else. Let me tell my crew you're here, I press on, taking a step back from Barrow's lean form. His eyes follow my movements, quietly assessing. He's only 19, little more than a year into his military service. But his training certainly stuck.
You mean, tell your watchdog.
A corner of my mouth lifts. His name is Tristan.
Tristan, right. Ginger hair, permanently glued to his rifle.
Barrow gives me my space, but follows all the same as I pick back toward the farmhouse.
Funny, I never expected to find a Southie embedded with you.
Southie? My voice doesn't quaver, despite Barrow's not-so-vague probing. His pace quickens until he's almost stepping on my heels. I fight the urge to kick back into his knee.
He's from Piedmont, has to be with his drawl. Not that it's much of a secret. Just like the rest of your bunch. All Lakelanders, yeah?
I glance over my shoulder. What gave you that idea?
And you're from the deep north, I suppose. Farther than our maps go.
He presses on. I get the feeling he enjoys this, like a puzzle.
You're in for some fun come true summer, when the days run long and thick with heat. Nothing like a week of storm clouds that never break, and air that threatens to drown. No wonder you're not a trench soldier, I say as we reach the door. There's no need for a poet on the front lines. The bastard actually winks at me. Well, we can't all be brutes. In spite of Tristan's many warnings, I follow Barrow unarmed. If I'm caught in Corvium, I can plead as a simple Red Norton in the wrong place at the wrong time. But not if I'm carrying my Lakelander pistol or a well-worn hunting knife. Then it'll be execution on the spot, not only for bearing arms without permission, but for being a Lakelander to boot. They'd probably slap me in front of a whisper for good measure, and that is the worst fate of all. While most cities sprawl, with smaller towns and neighborhoods ringing round their walls and boundaries, Corvium stands alone. Barrow stops just before the end of the tree line, looking north at the cleared landscape around a hill. My eyes scan over the fortress city, noting anything of use. I've pored over the stolen maps of Corvium, but seeing it with my own eyes is something else entirely. Black granite walls, spiked with gleaming iron, as well as other weapons to be harnessed by silver abilities. Green vines, thick as columns, coil up the dozen or so watchtowers. A moat of dark water fed by piping rings the entire city, and strange mirrors dot between the metal prongs fanging the parapets. For silver shadows, I assume, to concentrate their ability to harness light. And, of course, there are more traditional weapons to take stock of. The oil-dark watchtowers bristle with grounded heavy guns, artillery ready to fire on any and everything in the vicinity. And behind the walls, the buildings rise high, made tall by the cramped space. They too are black, tipped in gold and silver, a shadow beneath brighter sunlight. According to the maps, the city itself is organized like a wheel, with roads like spokes, all branching from the central square used to muster armies and stage executions. The Iron Road marches straight through the city from east to west. The Western Road is quiet. No marching this late in the afternoon. But the Eastern Road bustles with transports, most of them silver issue, carrying blue-blushing nobles and officers away from the fortress. The last, the slowest, is a red delivery convoy returning to the markets of Rocasta, the nearest supply city. It consists of servants in wheeled transports, in horse-drawn carts, even on foot, all making the 25-mile journey only to return again in a few days. I fish the spyglass from my jacket and hold it to my eye, following the ragged train. A dozen transports, as many carts, maybe 30 reds walking, all slow, keeping pace with each other. It'll take them at least 9 hours to get where they're going. A waste of manpower, but I doubt they mind. Delivering uniforms is safer than wearing them. As I watch, the last of the convoy leaves the eastern gate. The prayer gate, Barrow mutters. Hmm? He taps my glass, then points. We call it the prayer gate. As you enter, you pray to leave. As you leave, you pray never to return. I can't help but scoff. I didn't know Norta found religion. He only shakes his head. Then who do you pray to? No one, I guess. Just words at the end of it all. Somehow, in the shadow of Corvium, Shade Barrow's eyes find a bit of warmth. You get me in that gate, I'll teach you a prayer of my own. Rise, red as the dawn. Annoying as Barrow might be, I have a sneaking feeling he'll be scarlet soon enough. He tips his head, watching me as keenly as I watch him. Deal. Although I don't see how you plan to do it. Our best chance was that convoy, but unfortunately you're... What did you say? Chronologically challenged? No one's perfect. Not even me, he replies with a shit-eating grin. But I said I'd get you inside today, and I mean what I say. Eventually. I look him up and down, gauging his manner. I do not trust Barrow. It's not in me to truly trust anyone. But risk is part of the game. Are you going to get me shot? His grin widens. I guess you'll have to find out. Well then, how do we do this? To my surprise, he extends a long-fingered hand. I stare at it, confused. Does he mean to skip up to the gates like a pair of giggling children? Frowning, I cross my arms and turn my back. Well, let's get moving. A curtain of black blots my vision as Barrow slips a scarf over my eyes. I would scream if I could, signaling to Tristan following us from a quarter mile away. But the air is suddenly crushed from my lungs, and everything seems to shrink. I feel nothing but the tightening world and the warm bulk of Barrow's chest against my back. Time spins, everything falls, the ground tips beneath my feet. I hit concrete hard, enough to rattle an already rattling brain. The blindfold slips off, not that it does me much good. My vision spots, black against something darker, all of it still spinning. I have to shut my eyes again to convince myself I'm not spinning with it. My hands scrabble against something slick and cold, hopefully water, as I try to push myself back up. Instead, I fall backward and force my eyes open to find blue, dank darkness. The spots recede, slow at first, then all at once. What the f- I turn onto my knees, throwing up everything in my belly. Barrow's hand finds my back, rubbing what he assumes are soothing circles, but his touch makes my skin crawl. I spit, finished retching, and force myself to uneasy feet, if only to get away from him. He puts out a hand to steady me, but I smack it away, wishing I'd kept my knife. "Don't touch me," I snarl. "What was that? What happened? Where am I?"
"Careful. You're turning into a philosopher."
I spit acidic bile at his feet. "Barrow," I hiss. He sighs, annoyed as a schoolteacher. "I took you through the pipe tunnels. There's a few in the tree line. Had to keep you blinded, of course. Can't let all my secrets go for free."
"Pipe's my ass. We were standing outside a minute ago. Nothing moves that fast."
Barrow tries his best to smother a grin.
"You hit your head," he says after a long moment. "Passed out on the slide down."
That would explain the vomiting. Concussion. Yet I've never felt so alert. All the pain and nausea of the last few seconds are suddenly gone. Gingerly, I feel along my skull, searching for a bump or a tender spot. But there's nothing at all. He watches my examination with strangely focused attention. "Or do you think you ended up a half mile away, beneath the fortress of Corvium, some other way?"
"No, I suppose not."
As my eyes adjust to the gloom, I realize we're in a supply cellar. Abandoned or forgotten, judging by the dust on the empty shelves and the inch of standing water on the floor. I avoid looking at the fresh pile of sick. "Here, put these on." He fishes a grimy bundle of cloth from somewhere in the dark, carefully hidden but easy to find. It sails my way, colliding with my chest in a puff of dust and odor. "Wonderful," I mutter, unfolding it to find a regulation uniform. It's well worn, patched and stained with who knows what. The insignia is simple, a single white bar outlined in black. An infantry soldier, enlisted. A walking corpse.
"Whose body did you swipe this off?"
The shock of cold sparks in him again, only for a moment.
"It'll fit. That's all you need to worry about."
"Very well." I shrug out of my jacket without much fanfare, then peel off my battered pants and shirt in succession. My undergarments are nothing special, mismatched and thankfully clean, but Barrow stares anyway, his mouth open a little.
"Catching flies, Barrow,"
I taunt as I pull on the uniform trousers. In the dim light, they look red and battered as rusted pipes.
Sorry, he mutters, turning his head, then his body.
As if I care about privacy. I smirk at the blush spreading up his neck. I didn't think soldiers were so embarrassed by the female form. I press on as I zip myself into the uniform top. It's snug, but fits well enough. Obviously meant for someone shorter, with narrower shoulders. He whips back around. The flush has reached his cheeks. It makes him seem younger.
No, I realize. It makes him seem his age.
I didn't know Lakelanders were so free with them. I flash him a smile as cold as his eyes. I'm Scarlet Guard, boy. We have worse things to worry about than naked flesh.
Something trembles between us. A current of air, maybe, or perhaps the ache of my head injury finally coming back.
That must be it. Then Barrow laughs.
What?
You remind me of my sister.
It's my turn to grin.
You spy on her a lot, do you?
He doesn't flinch at the jab, letting it glance past.
In your manner, Farley, your ways, you think the same.
She must be a bright girl.
She certainly thinks so.
Very funny.
I think you two would be great friends.
Then he tips his head, pausing a second.
Or you might kill each other.
For the second time in as many minutes, I reluctantly touch Barrow. This is not so gentle as his hands on my back. Instead, I punch him lightly on the arm.
Let's get moving, I tell him.
I don't fancy standing around in a dead woman's clothes.
The following message has been decoded. Confidential. Senior clearance required. Captain, return to orders. Command won't stand for this. Ram. The following message has been decoded. Confidential. Command clearance required. Day 29 of Operation Shield Wall, Stage 2. Operative, Colonel, redacted. Designation, Ram. Origin, redacted. Destination, Drummer at, redacted. No contact from Lam in 2 days. Request permission to intercept. Shield Wall ahead of schedule. Island number 3, operational, but transit problematic. More boats needed than previously thought. Rise, red as the dawn. The following message has been decoded, confidential, senior clearance required. Operative, general, redacted. Designation, drummer. Origin, command at redacted. Destination, ram at redacted. Permission to intercept granted. Will relay further info re her location. Use force if necessary. She was your suggestion and your mistake if things continue. Get Red Web to Stage 2. Collab with other teams to begin removal. We'll explore other transit options for Number 3. Rise, red as the dawn. The following message has been decoded. Confidential. Senior clearance required. Lam, get your ass in line, or it's your head. Ram.
Another message to the fire.
Charming, I mutter, watching the colonel's words burn up. This time Kara doesn't bother to ask, but her lips purse into a thin line, holding back a torrent of questions. 5 days now since I've responded to any messages, official or otherwise. She obviously knows something is afoot. Kara, I begin, but she holds up a hand.
I don't have clearance, she replies.
Her eyes meet mine with startling ferocity.
And I don't care to know what path you're leading us down, so long as you think it's the right one.
A warmth fills my insides. I do my best to keep it from showing, but a bit of a smile bleeds out anyways. My hand finds her shoulder, offering her the smallest touch of thanks.
Don't get sappy on me now, Captain.
She chuckles, tucking away the broadcaster.
Will do.
I straighten, turning around to face the rest of my team. They cluster at the edge of the steaming alley, a respectful distance away to allow for my private correspondences. To hide our presence, Tristan and Rasha sit on the alley curb, facing the street beyond. They keep their hands out and their hoods up, begging for food or money. Everyone slides past, looking elsewhere.
Ty, Big Coop.
The pair in question steps forward. Ty tips her head, pointing her good ear at me, while Big Coop lives up to the nickname. With a chest like a barrel and almost 7 feet of heavy muscle, he's nearly twice the size of his brother, Little Coop. Stay with Kara. Keep the second radio ready. She extends a hand, all but itching to get hold of our newest prize. One of three top-of-the-line, techie-made, long-range secure radios, all swiped from the Corvium stores by Barrow's light fingers. I pass along the radio, though I keep the second tucked close. Barrow kept the third. Should he need to get in touch? Not that he's used it yet. Not that I'm keeping tally of his communications. Usually Barrow just shows up when he wants to trade information, always without warning, slipping past every spotter I put around the farmhouse. But today we're beyond even his sly reach. 25 miles east, in the middle of Rocasta. As for the rest, Christabel, Little Coop, you're on overwatch. Get high, get hidden, usual signals. Chris grins, showing a mouth of missing teeth. Punishment for smirking at her silver master back when she was a 12-year-old serving girl in a trial mansion. Little Coop is just as eager. His size and mousy demeanor, not to mention his brick wall of a brother, hide a skilled operative with a steel spine. Needing nothing more, they set to their work. Little Coop picks a drain pipe, scrabbling up the brick walls of the alley, while Chris scrambles to a fence, using it to boost herself onto a narrow window ledge. Both disappear in moments, to follow us from the Rocastan rooftops. The rest of you, track your marks, keep your ears open, memorize movements. I want to know everything from birthdays to shoe sizes. Gather whatever you can in the time we can. The words are familiar. Everyone knows why I called for this scout. But it serves as a rallying cry, one last thread drawing us together. Tying them to your disobedience, you mean? My fist curls, nails digging into my palm where no one can see. The sting erases the thought quite nicely, as does the breeze sweeping through the alley. It stinks of garbage, but it's cool at least, blowing off Lake Eris to the north. The more we know about the Corvium supply convoy, the easier it'll be to infiltrate. As good a reason as any to be here, to stay when all the Colonel does is tell me to leave. Gates close at sundown. Return to rally point within the hour. Understood? Their heads bob in taut unison, their eyes alive, bright and eager. A few blocks away, a clock tower chimes 9 times. I move without thought, stepping through my guardsmen as they fall in line behind me. Tristan and Rasha are the last to stand. My lieutenant looks bare without his rifle, but I know there's a pistol on him somewhere, probably collecting sweat at the base of his back. We head into the street, a main avenue through the red sector of the city. Safe for now, surrounded by nothing more than red homes and businesses, with few, if any, silver officers to watch us pass. As in Harbour Bay, Rocasta maintains its own red watch, to protect what silvers won't. Though we're heading for the same place, my team splits into their pairs, putting space between us. Can't exactly rove into the city centre looking like a jumped-up assault squad, let alone a gang. Tristan keeps close again, letting me lead us to our destination. The Iron Road. As in Corvium, the road bisects Rocasta, driving right through its heart, like river through valley. As we get closer to the main thoroughfare, traffic picks up. Late servants hurrying to the homes of their masters. Volunteer watchmen returning from their night posts. Parents hustling their children to ramshackle schools. And of course, more officers with every passing street. Their uniforms, black with silver trim, are severe in the harsh sun of late spring, as are the gleaming guns and clubs at their waists. Funny, they feel the need to wear uniforms, as if they're at risk of being mistaken for red. One of us. Not a chance. Their skin, undershot with blue and grey, leached of everything alive, is distinguishing enough. There is no red on earth so cold as a silver. 10 yards ahead of us, Rasha stops so quickly her partner, Martinson, almost trips over her. No mean feat, considering she has about 6 inches on the graying little papa. Next to me, Tristan tenses, but doesn't break formation. He knows the rules. Nothing is above the guard, not even affection. The silver legionnaires drag a boy by the arms. His feet kick at open air. He's small, looking young for 18. I doubt he needs to shave. I do my best to block out the sound of his begging, but his mother's wail cannot be ignored. She follows, 2 more children on her heels, with a solemn father trailing behind. Her hands clutch at her son's shirt, offering 1 last bout of resistance to his conscription. The street seems to hold its breath as one, watching the familiar tragedy. A crack echoes, and she falls backward, clutching a bruising cheek. The legionnaire didn't even lift a finger or even look up from his grim work. He must be a Telki, and used his abilities to swat the woman away.
"You want worse," he snaps when she moves to stand.
"Don't," the boy says, using his last free words to beg.
"This will not last. This will not continue. This is why I'm here."
Even so, it makes me sick to know I cannot do anything for this boy and his mother. Our plans are falling into place, but not fast enough for him. Perhaps he will survive, I tell myself. But 1 look at his thin arms and the eyeglasses trampled beneath a legionnaire's foot says otherwise. The boy will die like so many others, in a trench or in a wasteland, alone at the very end. "I can't watch this," I mutter, and turn down another alley. After a long moment of strange hesitation, Tristan follows. I can only hope Rasha stays the course as well as he does, but I understand. She lost 2 sisters to Latelander conscriptions and fled her home before meeting the same fate. Rocastor is not a walled city and has no gates to choke the ends of the Iron Road. An easy place to enter, but it makes our task a bit more difficult. The main body of the returning supply convoy comes along the road, but a few of the walking escorts peel off, taking different shortcuts to the same destination. On another day, my team would spend hours tracking them all to their homes, only to watch them sleep off the long journey. Not so now, because it's First Friday. Today is the Feet of July. A ridiculous Norton tradition, albeit an effective one, if the intelligence is to be believed. Arenas in almost every town and city, casting long shadows and spitting blood once a month. Reds are required to attend, to sit and watch silver champions exchange blows and abilities with the glee of stage performers. We have no such thing in the Lakelands. Silvers don't feel the need to show off against us, and the storied threat of Norta is enough to keep everyone terrified.
"They do it in Piedmont, too," Tristan mutters. He leans against the poured concrete fence edging the promenade around the arena's entrance.
Our gazes flick in unison, one of us always watching our marks, another always watching the band of officers directing people into the gaping maw of Arena Rocastor.
"Call them acts, not feats.
And we didn't just have to watch. Sometimes they made Reds fight too." I hear the tremor of rage in his voice, even above the organized chaos of today's spectacle. I nudge his shoulder as gently as I can.
"Fight each other? Kill Reds or be killed by Silvers? I don't know which is worse."
"Targets aren't moving," he simply growls. 1 more glance at the officers, now occupied with a band of mangy kids halting foot traffic. "Let's go, and let that wound fester with the rest." I push off the wall next to him and slip into the crowd, eyes trained on the four red uniforms up ahead. It isn't easy. This close to Corvium, there's a lot of red military, either marching through to take their places in the choke, or attached to different convoys like the one we're tailing. But the four men, three bronze, one dark-skinned, all bone-tired, keep close to each other. We haunt their footsteps. They manned a horse cart for the convoy, carrying what, I'm not sure. It was empty when they returned with the rest. But judging by the lack of security in Silvers, I know their supply train isn't for weaponry or ammunition. The three bronze men are brothers, I assume, judging by their similar faces and mannerisms. It's almost comical to watch them spit and scratch their behinds in staggered unison. The fourth, a burly fellow with vividly blue eyes, is subdued in his itching, though he smiles more than the rest put together. Krantz, I think his name is, based on my eavesdropping. We enter the arches of the arena entrance like prowling cats, close enough to hear our marks, but not be noticed. Overhead, harsh electric lights flicker, illuminating the high-ceilinged chamber connecting the outer promenade to the interior. The crowd thickens to our left, where a variety of reds wait to place their bets on the ensuing match. Above it, the boards announce the Silvers to fight and their odds of victory. Flora Larolan, Oblivion, 3-1. Maddox Thaney, Stoneskin, 10-1. "Hang on a second," Krantz says, halting the rest by the betting boards. With a grin, one of the bronze men joins him. The pair dig in their pockets for something to gamble. Under the pretense of doing the same, Tristan and I stop no more than a few feet away, hidden in the swelling crowd. The betting boards are popular among the Reds of Rocasta, where a thriving military economy keeps most from going hungry. There are several well-to-do among the crowd, merchants and business owners in proudly clean clothes. They make their bets and hand over dull coppers, even a few silver tetrarchs. I bet the till of Arena Rocasta is nothing to sneer at, and make a note to pass on such information to command. If they'll still listen to me. "Come on, look at the odds, it's easy money." Still smiling infectiously, Krantz points between the boards and the betting windows. The other two tailing along don't look so convinced.
"You know something about Stoneskins we don't," the tallest says. "He'll get blown to pebbles by the Oblivion."
"Suit yourself, Horner, but I didn't trudge all the way from Corvium to sit bored in the stands."
Bills in hand, Krantz slips away with his friend on his heels, leaving Horner and the other man to wait. Somehow, despite Krantz's size, he's surprisingly good at cutting through a crowd. Too good.
"Watch them," I murmur with a touch to Tristan's elbow. And then I'm weaving too, careful to keep my head angled at the ground.
There are cameras here, enough to be wary of. Should the next few weeks go as planned, I might want to start hiding my face. I see it as Krantz passes his paper through the window. His sleeve lifts as it scrapes the betting ledge, pulling back to reveal a tattoo. It almost blends into his umber skin, but the shape is unmistakable. I've seen it before. Blue anchor, red rope. We're not the only crew working this convoy. The Mariners already have a man inside. This is good. We can work with this. My mind fires as I fight my way back. Pay for their information. Less guard involvement, but the same outcome. And odds are the Mariner is alone, working the job solo. We could try to turn him, get our own eyes inside the Mariners, start pulling strings, absorb the gang into the guard. Tristan stands ahead above the crowd, still watching the other two marks. I fight the urge to sprint to his side and divulge everything. But an obstacle sprouts between us. A bald man and a familiar sheen of sweat across his brow. Lakelander. Before I can run or shout, a hand closes around my throat from behind. tight enough to keep me quiet, loose enough to let me breathe, and certainly enough to drag me through the crowd with Baldy keeping close. Another might thrash or fight, but I know better. Silver officers are everywhere here, and their help is not anything I want to risk. Instead, I put my trust in myself and in Tristan. He must keep watch, and I must get free. The crowd takes us in its current, and still I cannot see who it is marching me through. Baldy's bulk hides most of me, as does the scarf my captor tosses around my neck. Funny, it's scarlet. And then we climb, up the steps, high above the arena floor, to long slab seats that are mostly abandoned. Only then am I released, pushed to sit. I whirl in a fury, fists clenched and ready, only to find the colonel staring back, very much prepared for my rage. "You want to add striking your commanding officer to your list of offences," he says. "It's almost a purr." "No, I don't." Glumly, I drop my fists. Even if I could fight my way past Baldy, I don't want to try myself at the colonel and his wiry strength. I raise a hand to my neck instead, massaging the now tender skin beneath the red scarf. "It won't bruise," he continues. "Your mistake. I thought you wanted to send a message. Nothing says get your ass back in line like a blue neck." His red eye flashes. "You stop responding, and think I'll let that go? Not a chance, Captain. Now tell me what's going on here. What of your team? Have you all gone rogue, or did some run off?" "No one's run off," I force through gritted teeth. "Not one of them. No one's rogue either. They're still following orders." "At least someone is." "I am still under operation, whether you choose to see it or not. Everything I'm doing here is for the cause, for the guard. Like you said, this isn't the Lakelands. And while getting the whistle network online is priority, so is Corvium." I have to hiss to be heard over the crowding arena. "We can't rely on the slow creep here. Things are too centralized. People will notice, and they'll root us out before we're ready. We have to hit hard, hit big, hit where the Silvers can't hide us." I'm gaining ground, but not much. Still, it's enough for him to keep his voice from shaking. He's angry, but not livid. He can still be reasoned with. "That's precisely what you recorded for," he says. "You remember, I assume." A camera and a red scarf across half my face. A gun in one hand, a newly made flag in the other, reciting words memorized like a prayer. "And we will rise up, red as the dawn." "Farley, this is how we operate. No one holds all the cards. No one knows the hand. It's the only way we stay ahead and alive," he presses on. From another, it might sound like pleading, but not the colonel. He doesn't ask things, he just orders. "But believe me when I say, we have plans for Norta, and they aren't so far from what you want." Below us, the champions of the feet march out onto the strange grey sand. One, the Thaney Stoneskin, has a boulder belly and is nearly as wide as he is tall. He has no need for armor and is naked to the waist. For her part, the Oblivion looks every inch her ability. Dressed in interlocking plates of red and orange, she dances like a nimble flame. "And do those plans include Corvium?" I whisper, turning back to the colonel. I must make him understand. "Do you think me so blind that I wouldn't notice if there was another operation in this city? Because there isn't. There's no one here but me. No one else seems to care about that fortress where every single red doomed to die passes through. Every single one. And you think that place isn't important?" Corporal Eastree flashes in my head. Her grey face and grey eyes, her stern resolve. She spoke of slavery, because that's what this world is. No one dares say it. But that's what reds are. slaves and graves. For once, the colonel holds his tongue.
Good, or else I might cut it out.
You go back to command, and you tell someone else to continue with Red Webb. Oh, and let them know the mariners are here, too. They're not so short-sighted as the rest of us. Part of me expects to be slapped for insubordination. In all our years, I've never spoken to him like this. Not even in the north. At the frozen place we all used to call home. But I was a child then, a little girl pretending to be a hunter, gutting rabbits and setting bad snares to feel important. I am not her anymore. I am 22 years old, a captain of the Scarlet Guard, and no one, not even the colonel, can tell me I am wrong now. Well? After a long, trembling moment, he opens his mouth. No. An explosion below matches my rage. The crowd gasps in time with the fight, watching as the wispy Oblivion tries to live up to her odds. But the mariner was right. The stone skin will win. He is a mountain against her fire, and he will endure. My team will stand with me, I warn. You'll lose 10 good soldiers and 1 captain to your pride, Colonel. No, Captain. Someone else is not going to take over Red Webb from you, he says. But I will petition command for a Corvium operation, and when they've secured a team, it will take your place. When? Not if. I can barely believe what he's saying. Until such time, you will remain in Corvium and continue work with your contacts. Relay all pertinent information through the usual channels. But command is more open-minded than you know, and for whatever reason, they think the world of you. I can't tell if you're lying. He merely raises one shoulder, shrugging. His eyes rove back to the arena floor, to watch as the stone skin rips the young Oblivion apart. Somehow, his reason grates on me more than anything else. It's hard to hate him in a time like this, when I remember who he used to be. And then, of course, I remember the rest. What he did to us, to our family, to my mother and sister, who were not so horrible as we were, who could not survive in the monster he made. I wish he wasn't my father. I've wished it so many times. How goes Shield War? I murmur to keep my thoughts at bay. Ahead of schedule. Not a hint of pride, just sober fact. But transit could be an issue once we set in on removal. Supposedly the second stage of my operation. The removal and transport of assets deemed useful to the Scarlet Guard. Not just Reds who would pledge to the cause, but ones who can fire a gun, drive a transport, read, fight. I shouldn't know, I begin, but he cuts me off. I get the feeling he doesn't have anyone to talk to, if Baldy is any indication. Now that I'm gone. Command gave me 3 boats. 3. They think 3 boats can help get an entire island populated and working. Somewhere in my brain, a bell rings. And on the floor, the stone skin raises his rocky arms, victorious. Skin healers tend to the Oblivion girl, fixing up her broken jaw and crushed shoulders with quick touches. Krantz will be happy. Does command ever mention pilots? I wonder aloud. The colonel turns, one eyebrow raised. Pilots? For what? I think my man inside Corvium can get us something better than boats, or at least a way to steal something better than boats. Another man would smile, but the colonel simply nods. Do it.
The following message has been decoded. Confidential. Command clearance required. Operative, Colonel Redacted. Designation, RAM. Origin, Rocasta, NRT. Destination, command, @redacted. Contact made with Lamb. Her team still online. No losses. Assessment. Corvium worth an operation team. Suggest mercy. Suggest a rush. Lamb will hand off and return to Red Web. Lamb passing intelligence vital to shield wall and removal transit. Returning to post. Rise, red as the dawn. The following message has been decoded, confidential. Senior clearance required. Operative, general, redacted. Designation, drummer. Origin, command, at redacted. Destination, RAM at redacted. LAM at Corvium, NRT. Corvium suggestion under advisement. Captain Farley will return to Red Web in 2 days. Command split on punishment as is, awaiting intelligence. Rise, red as the dawn. The following message has been decoded. Confidential, senior clearance required. Operative, Captain Redacted. Designation, LAM. Origin, Corvium, NRT. Destination, RAM at redacted. Command at redacted. Request a week. Rise, red as the dawn. You're a special kind of stupid, kid. RAM. The following message has been decoded, confidential, senior clearance required. Operative, general, redacted. Designation, drummer. Origin, command at redacted. Destination, RAM at redacted. LAM at Corvium, NRT. 5 days, no more negotiation. Rise, red as the dawn. Somehow the farmhouse has begun to feel like a home. Even with the collapsed roof, the tents wicked with humidity, and the silence of the woods. It's the longest I've been anywhere since Irabel. But that was always base. And while the soldiers there are the closest thing I have to family, I never could see the cold concrete and maze-like passages as anything more than a way station. A place to train and wait for the next assignment. Not so with the ruin on the doorstep of the killing grounds, and the shadow of a grave city. That's it, I tell Kara, and lean back against the closet wall. She nods and folds away the broadcaster. Nice to see you all chatting again. Before I can laugh, Tristan's neat knock jars the shuttered excuse for a door. Got company. Barrow. Duty calls, I grumble as I scoot past Kara, bumping her in the closed space. Wrenching open the door, I'm surprised to find Tristan standing so close, his usual nervous energy on overdrive. Spotter's got him this time, finally, he says. On another day, he might be proud, but something about this sets him off. I know why. We never see Barrow coming. So why today? Signaled, it's important. Behind him, the farmhouse door bangs open, revealing a red-faced Barrow flanked by Chris and little Coop. One look at his terrified face is enough. Scatter, I snap. They know what it means. They know where to go. A hurricane moves through the farmhouse, taking home with it. The guns, the provisions, our gear disappears in a practiced heartbeat, shoved into bags and packs. Chris and little Coop are already gone, into the trees, to get as high as they can. Their mirrors and bird calls will carry the message to the others in the woods. Tristan supervises the rest, all while loading his long rifle. There isn't time! They're coming now! Barrow hisses, suddenly at my side. He takes my elbow, and not gently. You have to go! 2 snaps of my fingers. The team obeys, dropping whatever isn't packed away. I guess we'll have to steal some more tents down the line, but it's the least of my worries. Another snap and they fly like bullets from a gun. Kara, Ty, Rasha, and the rest going through the door and the collapsed wall in all directions with all speed. The woods swallow them whole. Tristan waits for me because it's his job. Barrow waits because I don't know. Farley, he hisses, another tug at my arm. I cast one last glance, making sure we have everything, before making my own escape into the tree line. The men follow, keeping pace with my sprint through tangled roots and brush. My heart pounds in my ears, beating a harried drum. We've had worse. We've had worse. Then I hear the dogs.
Anima's controlled hounds. They'll smell us, they'll follow, and the Swifts will run us down. If we're lucky, they'll think we're deserters and killers in the forest. If not, I don't want to think about what horrors the Black City of Corvium holds. Get to water, I force out. They'll lose the scent. But the river is a half mile on. I only hope they take the time to search the farmhouse, giving us the window we need to escape. At least the others are farther on, spread wide. No pack can follow us all. But me, us, the freshest, closest scent? Easy prey. Despite the protest in my muscles, I push harder and run faster than I ever have before. But after only a minute, I start to tire. If only I could run as fast as my thundering heart. Tristan slows with me, though he doesn't need to. There's a creek, he hisses, pointing south. Shoot off the river, closer, you head for it. What are you talking about? I can make it to the river. You can't, and they can't follow us both. My eyes widen. I almost trip in my confusion, but Barrow catches me before I can, sternly helping me over a gnarled root. Tristan! My lieutenant only smiles and pats the gun slung across his back. Then he points. That way, boss. Before I can stop him, before I can order him not to, he leaps through the trees, using his long legs and the lower branches to vault over worsening ground. I can't shout after him. Somehow I don't even get a good look at his face. Only a mop of red hair, gleaming through the green. Barrow all but shoves me. I think he looks relieved, but that can't be right. Especially when a dog howls not 100 yards away, and the trees above us seem to bow, their branches reaching like cloying fingers. Green Wardens, Animosi, Swifts, the Silvers will catch us both.
Farley.
Suddenly both his hands are on my jaw, forcing me to look at a shockingly calm face. There's fear, of course, flickering in his golden eyes. But not nearly enough for the situation. Not like me. I am terrified.
You have to promise not to scream.
What?
Promise.
I see the first dog, a hound the size of a pony, its jowls dripping. And next to it, a grey blur like the wind made flesh.
Swift.
Again, I feel the squeeze of Shade's body against mine, and then something less pleasant. The tightening of the world, the spin, the tipping forward through empty air. All of it compounds and contracts, and I think I see green stars. Or maybe trees. I feel a familiar wave of nausea first. This time I land in a stream bed instead of on concrete. I sputter, spitting water and bile, fighting the urge to scream or be sick or both. Barrow crouches over me, one hand raised.
Ah. Don't scream.
Sick it is.
I suppose that's preferable at the moment,
he mutters, kindly looking anywhere but my green face.
Sorry, I guess I need more practice.
Or maybe you're just sensitive. The gurgling stream cleans up what I can't, and the cold water does more for me than a mug of black coffee. I snap to attention, looking around at the trees bowing over us.
Willows.
Not oaks, like where we were just seconds ago.
They're not moving, I realized with a swell of relief.
No Green Wardens here. No dogs either. But then, where are we?
How?
I whisper, my voice ragged. Don't say pipes. The practiced shield of Shade Barrow drops a little. He takes a few steps back from me so he can sit on a stone above the stream, perching like a gargoyle.
I don't quite have an explanation,
he says, as if he's admitting a crime.
The best I can do is show you. And again, you have to promise not to scream.
Dully, I nod. My head swims, still off balance. I can barely sit up in the stream, let alone shout. He heaves a breath, his fingers gripping the stone until his knuckles turn white.
Okay.
And then he's gone. Not,
Not from running away, or hiding, or even falling off the rock. He just simply isn't. I blink, not believing what I see.